Each one of these 300-pound beasts is lovingly marinated, basted, roasted, and then hacked apart by owners Tomas and Carmen, yielding one of the most sublime meats imaginable. Mmm, pig.
Well, clearly we're going to have to eat here. I want some head, I want some ass, and I want some... That doesn't sound good, does it?
Hello, everybody. My name is Phil, and this is my life as a foodie. We've reached a bit of a milestone, and I want to welcome you to our one-year anniversary on this show. Thank you for tuning in. I feel a little lucky, actually, to make it this far. And I've been looking forward to, seeing the show's progression. So, you know, podcasts in general don't really have a long lifespan. You know, I'm not sure if any of you know that. So you kind of have to admire podcasts that have stuck it out longer than 2 or 3 years. You know, shows like Big Foamy Head, The Good Beer Show, you know, that's kind of rare because they've been at it for so long. They've been doing it for so long. But there are lots of beer safari shows that are looking at 3+ years and really don't show signs of slowing down. So when you think about it, the Beer Safari really does have a lot of shows with a considerable amount of success in regards to longevity. And some podcasts only last a few episodes. I know some podcasts, personal podcasts, that, lasted 4 or 5 episodes and then just dropped. Hats off to those that have lasted. I hope I can last. I was planning on pulling clips of, some of these shows that I just mentioned to kind of show how other podcasts kind of celebrate their anniversaries. But once I started, it kind of bummed me out because, I do the show alone and there really isn't another glass to clink and celebrate with. So I figured it was best to just say congratulations to all the other podcasts and then wish my own show a happy anniversary and hope I can push this thing, to about 2 years before I lose everybody. But before I move on with the show, I wanted to do a little recap of what has happened in the past year and what I expect to bring in the coming year. You know, when I started this, I really didn't know what the hell I was going to do. I really didn't know what I was doing. I thought of making it a beer gourmet show. I toyed with that idea. I was throwing ideas back and forth with Father Spoon from Should I Drink That? I was going to do this thing called the Beer Gourmet, where I picked a beer and then I picked a food to go along with it, and I would cook it, and that was going to be it, But that kind of seemed a little too one-dimensional, so I figured I'd just talk about whatever came to my mind in regards to food and beer, and that's pretty much what I've stuck with. And it's kind of been a lifestyle for me for a long time, so bringing that to a podcast kind of just made sense. So 2 shows in, I read this book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, by Barbara Kingsolver and Stephen Hupp. I've talked about it. That's kind of when things changed for me, and I started to really think about making this show more about my support of farmers, farming, and whole foods, things like that. Not that I have any really set agenda against fast food, because I really don't. I've said here a lot, it serves its purpose. And when you need something quick, and that's all that's really there for you, thank God it's there. You stuff it down, you get on with your business. It's the habitual fast food eater that I'm really trying to help here. Whenever I rag on eateries that cater to lazy people who just don't want to cook for themselves, or they're stuck eating the same thing every day, we're a real blessed nation. We've got so many people from many different countries living here, and they've all brought their food and their kitchens with them. So giving that a chance, getting out there and trying something different, experiencing that bit of home that Hung Nguyen or Hamir Hubasa have brought to the States. That's all I'm really saying. It doesn't take much. It's not going to kill you. And God forbid, you might like it. I did notice one thing. I've gone an entire year on the show without eating any Mexican food. And I find that incredibly short-sighted on my part since I live here in California. And we've got a vast amount of Mexican food at our disposal. And good Mexican food. I had so many plans this year that fell through. Mexican food was definitely one of them. I was going to visit a taco truck with my friend Don, but that didn't pan out. I was going to have more guests on the show. That didn't pan out either. If there was a highlight, I guess it was having Sean on, Sean the ag student. And he talked about his experiences on the farm and his experiences as an ag student and what it was like. And he's graduating soon. So I hope to have him in at some point again, have a little graduation party for him, maybe on the air. If Sean, if you are listening, congratulations on your graduation. Now go get a job. I want to start promoting a local brewery that's here in Orange County that's just opening up. I've not been able to get there yet, but I was invited to the grand opening party a couple weeks ago. It just so happened that I had a commitment that day. I couldn't break it, so I couldn't make it to their party. However, I do plan on making it down there. The brewery's called The Brewery, B-R-U-E-R-Y. The head brewmaster is Patrick Rue. He seems like a really great guy. He emailed me. He heard my show through Rick Sellers at Pacific Brew News, where I actually caught wind of him. So soon I'll be headed over there to taste his beers. I'll give you guys a 411. For now, let me just say this. There is no way this is going to suck. I mean, just on paper, his beers look and sound fantastic. He's doing really interesting beers, a few Belgians. Reminds me a lot of port brewing here in San Marcos. The parallels are kind of similar. At least they look that way to me. They're started by an award-winning Southern California home brewer. You know, same thing with the brewery. Word gets out. Next thing you know, they're the next big hit. And it just so happens that port brewing is what we're going to feature on today's show. Port brewing is part of Pizza Port, which you may remember was the host of the Southern California Real Ale Festival. We did the first Dude Night video from that in 2006. A few years ago, Stone moved into their gigantic brewery in Escondido. Port Brewing took over the old digs in San Marcos. That's where they're brewing their beer now. So there's a relationship between Stone and Port Brewing. They've supported each other quite a bit. Port Brewing was started by Vince and Gina Marsaglia. Okay. They started brewing their beer at home in 1992, and then they wanted to start sharing their beer with their customers. So in October of that year, they built a 7-barrel brewery, and they installed it. In 1993, first handcrafted brew was delivered on premises in Solano Beach. It was served there. The Solano Beach's Pizza Port became famous for fresh and hoppy beers, and that prompted the addition of two more Pizza Port locations in Carlsbad and in San Clemente. Now, even with three brewing systems, there just wasn't enough capacity for these people. This is how popular their beer was. You know, outside of the restaurants, they just could not deliver their beer. So people started asking, where can I get your beer, you know, besides the pizzeria? So Vince and Gina knew they had to expand, and it just so happened that Stone was moving out in March of 2006. Pizza Port Brewing, or Port Brewing Company is what they turned out to be called. They acquired the old Stone Brewing facility in San Marcos, and here we are today. So today I'm going to have, on the first time on the show, and the only time I've ever had it was in Pizza Port in San Clemente. I met Don up there for some beers after work one day. I'm going to have their Hop 15 Double IPA. I've talked about and had Double IPAs on the show before, so I'm not going to go through the whole thing of explaining what it is. You know the difference between a regular IPA, a double, an imperial, quadruple, extra fragilicious IPA. You know all that stuff. All right, we're going to have some now. Oops. Didn't mean to bump you. Pour is nice. It's got a nice mid-amber color, not too dark. Smells good. Kind of smells like fruit, like, I don't know, peaches or apricots. Smells great. I love smelling IPAs. You know, if I get snooty about beer, it's usually around IPAs or Belgians. Those two beers especially. I just stick my nose right in and start sniffing. And I'll taste it. It's round. It's a lot rounder than I thought it would be. It's citrusy. Very much like most IPAs. It's got a little bit of a dry finish, just a tiny bit of bitterness, but just enough. It's not horrible. You know, some IPAs are just real mouth puckers, and I just don't care for that. This is very good. It's just how it should be. Oh, I could really drink this. Awesome. I love it. I'll give it a 9 out of 10. It's really, really good. If you want to know what a 10 would be in my book, Stone's IPA and Pliny the Elder from Russian River Brewing, just so you know where this one ranks, pretty damn close. It's good. Very good. They say what's in it, two-row and English light crystal malted barley, 15 different varieties of hops. That's why they call it Hop 15. They say it's on a strictly don't ask, don't tell policy, so we'll have to guess, but I'm not going to try to call out 15 varieties of hops. They use White Labs California Ale and proprietary yeast strain, which is pretty common for beers like this. I use a Cal Ale yeast in my Hop Team and IPA, my homebrew. Sierra Nevada invented it, so they use it. And I think Stone uses something similar like that, too. Original gravity, 1086. Terminal gravity, 1014. 9.7 ABV. My God, that's a fat one. Did taste a little strong, but I wouldn't have guessed almost 10%. That's pretty good. That's masked pretty well. It's available here in Southern California. They sell it in 22-ounce bottles, which is how I have it. I sell it in cases. You can go to Port Brewing and drink it at San Marcos, or the Pizza Port in Carlsbad, San Clemente, and Solana Beach. I don't believe there's nationwide distribution just yet, but I say give them a little bit of time. And they make a lot of IPAs, a lot of different varieties of IPA. So it's interesting that they use 15 different hops in this beer. That's pretty impressive. So one of the big stories this past week has been this tomato scare here in California, and I believe now it's nationwide. You may or may not have heard about it, but let me tell you something. If you pay attention to the details of this story, it will drive home what I've been getting at for like the last 9 months. Buy American, buy American, buy American. That is if you live in America. I mean, if you live in England, buy English, but and so on. But what I've been getting at is not just to support the farms here because it helps the farmers, but because we cannot trust the food from other countries. There's no control. There's no quality control on any of the stuff that's being brought in here. And Sean brought that up himself. He said the FDA, just they don't give a shit. And now here's proof again. Salmonella in farm-raised tomatoes imported from somewhere that is not California. Here's the story, just in case you haven't heard it. It appeared on Lou Dobbs' show on CNN earlier this week. And can I just say right now, God bless Lou Dobbs. Near the end of this, he attacks the FDA for refusing country of origin labeling. And now Lou Dobbs is my new hero.
An outbreak of salmonella tonight spreading across the country. There are already 150 cases of salmonella poisoning connected to several different varieties of tomatoes. McDonald's, Burger King, and a number of other major food outlets have pulled tomatoes from their menus. As Louise Schiavone now reports, the government agencies responsible for protecting us have absolutely no idea where these contaminated tomatoes originated.
Once again, in areas of the U.S., people are getting sick from the food they eat. This time, it's tomatoes. And so far, the Food and Drug Administration has no idea how it started.
We have to recognize that the complexity of this may be such that we may not be able to pin it down to a specific field or a specific location. But we're working towards that.
Today, the commissioner paid a personal visit to an FDA lab in California, where foods like these tomatoes are being tested.
It may be a matter of days, a few days, before we have enough evidence to be able to make a conclusive statement about that source, or it could be perhaps longer than just a matter of a couple days.
In 2002, we told this administration to give us country of origin labeling. At least we would know these tomatoes would have people sickened in 16 different states with salmonella. We'd at least know if they were grown here in the United States.
Across 16 states from California to Connecticut, there have been 145 tomato-related salmonella cases, including about two dozen hospitalizations since mid-April. Salmonella can cause fever and acute intestinal distress. The tomatoes in question, raw red plum, red round, and red Roma tomatoes. The FDA's investigative approach here is to work backwards from illness outbreaks, determining first where the tomatoes are not from.
We're seeing FDA do instead by announcing the places that the tomatoes are not from is essentially they're looking for a needle in a haystack. But instead of holding up the needle, they're holding up all the hay and saying, this is not the needle.
The FDA recommends that restaurants stop serving sliced raw tomatoes.
And so, Lou, we wait, as the FDA says, it could be days or longer before we know what the source of the contamination is.
You know, I love these government officials like the commissioner of the FDA suggesting that, you know, this is hard work. It's sort of a refrain from President Bush. It's hard work. That's what we pay these people to do, but we pay them to get this done before people get sick and their lives endangered. It's inexcusable. And we should point out that the country of origin labeling was passed by Congress in 2003. But the industry has lobbied and successfully gamed the system to the point that we still do not have country of origin labeling. And I personally believe that we're going to find, when this is all said and done, I'll step out on a limb. I think that there right now some people are trying to be very careful of some of those countries of origin. They don't want to, they're trying to manage, I believe, part of the PR here. And that's unfortunate.
It's very tricky diplomatically. And what's interesting is when the FDA goes before Congress, they say constantly, we set the gold standard for food safety. We set the gold standard for drug safety. And if this is the gold standard, we're in trouble.
Yeah. And unfortunately, 150 people in even more trouble.
Okay. So it's all over the news here, of course. And my wife noticed something that really irritated her. They were showing these supermarkets, restaurants, other places where they're either selling or serving tomatoes while they're doing this news report. Then they show a farmer's market. I mean, like, wait a second. A farmer's market? You know what you buy at a farmer's market here in California? California-grown tomatoes. They were cleared by the FDA, you jackasses. Why show the farmer's market? That's the one place you can actually buy them and not worry about salmonella. Thanks for the bad PR, you know? I mean, please. And thank you again for not doing your job, too, FDA. Another thing she brought up, which I thought was really interesting, was that schools here in California pulled all of their tomatoes and took anything with tomatoes off the school lunch menu. So that means that they're also buying and using imported produce. Because if they were using California-grown tomatoes, there wouldn't be an issue. So even our schools can't support the local farms, it appears. Huh. How interesting is that? Like I said, it's all over the news. By now, by the time this airs or by the time this is on the internet, the scare may be over, but the whole analogy that they used to instead of holding up the needle, they held up the haystack, I thought that was pretty good. FDA drops the ball again. Gee, what a shock. Recently, I visited this local Asian restaurant that my wife and I like to hit for lunch on the weekends. Now and again, we'll be out. And if we're near this place, we'll go and we'll have lunch. It's a small hole-in-the-wall eatery. It's called Okidoki. O-K-I-D-O-K-I. I know a lot of people who are going to snub their noses at it. A lot of people, you know, they're a bit pretentious about which Asian places they want to go to. But F them. I like the food. I like the food a lot. When we go there for lunch, we're usually just going to have noodles because we're kind of on the run and we don't want anything too heavy. But they make really good egg rolls and rice noodles, and they have what they call pho, but it's really not pho. It's a chicken-based broth with egg or rice noodles, some shrimp, dumplings, thinly sliced beef or pork. It's a good bowl of soup. It's not pho, but it's a good bowl of soup. But dinner is something else entirely, and we went there for dinner. When Okidoki serves dinner, it's considered an izakaya. They call it izakaya style. An izakaya is a Japanese bar. It's a kind of a Japanese bar. They serve food to accompany the drinks that they serve, but it's not really a bar. It's more like a restaurant because they serve a lot of really good food to go with the drinks. So it's a lot more substantial, say, than what you get in a bar in Japan. You know, it's not like you go and you're having peanuts or nachos. You know, it's a real bar. And in Japan, you know, the food is a lot more intense. Izakaya are popular. They're in Japan, they're real casual, they're relatively cheap places to go. You go after work, you have some drinks, eat some food, you know, stay out late, and then you wake up, you go to work, and you do the whole thing over again. At an izakaya, you have things like yakitori, which are grilled skewers of meat, usually chicken, sashimi, different types of sushi, rolls, edamame, hayayako, which is chilled silken tofu with different toppings, or some deep-fried tofu in a broth or a soup, a wide variety of Japanese pickles, things like that. So what you do is you order a bunch of different things and you share them on your table. And then you order drinks to go with it. You know, beer, sake, soju, wine, an assortment of different cocktails, whatever you like that you think would accompany the food best. You drink, you eat, you talk, laugh, you just party until you've had enough. And then ordinarily you jump to another izakaya and you do it all again. And by the end of the night, you're drunk, you're full, you're out of money, but it's really worth it. And that being said, we're not really young anymore, so we just went there for dinner. You know, we just wanted to experience that. We had a little sake, a little Sapporo, but that's about it. Here's what we had. First thing we did, we ordered 4 egg rolls, $5.
Okay, this is pretty cheap to order this stuff. They're made by wrapping chopped cabbage, some ground pork, rice noodles into a sheet of spring roll dough. And then they roll them up, and then they deep fry them, and they serve them with a sweet dipping sauce. Next came grilled squid, $6. This was a whole calamari. It was sliced into pieces and then served in a shoyu-based broth. Outstanding. Maybe the best way that I have ever had calamari. Seriously, it was that good. I could have eaten it all night. We also ordered a baked spicy California roll. That was $6.50. Now, you want to talk about something that just fills you up the minute you start eating it. It's like something you put in your mouth and immediately start to feel full. It's a California roll. Rice is on the outside. It's stuffed with imitation crab, mayonnaise, cucumber, and avocado. Then it's topped with some spicy red stuff. I really couldn't identify it, but it was torched or pre-baked. It was hot, creamy, spicy, really, really delicious, awfully good. I could have sat and just eaten that all night long and not eaten anything else. I mean, I don't know how these young kids can snack on this stuff and not blow up into a million pieces. And I wanted to be lathered in whatever this was topped with. Then came a crunchy roll, and that was $6.50. By this time, seriously, I'm crying uncle. I mean, I'm thinking maybe we ordered too much food. Again, it's a California roll, rice is on the outside, but there's some deep-fried shrimp rolled up inside of this thing. Then they top it with bits of fried tempura batter, and they drizzle a shoyu-based sauce across the top. I put pictures of everything on the website, of course. There's a little slideshow from RockU. Mind you, I'm doing most of the eating here, all right? My wife helps, but, you know, she's a couple bites, and then she's like, oh, you can have the rest. So I'm doing most of the eating. 2 bites into this last dish, I'm thinking my pants are going to just split open. I mean, I'm really getting full. Now, I've got to struggle to get past the crunchy roll, too, pretty much by myself. And then the beer doesn't help. And that's really, it's a big reason why I rarely order beer out when I'm having dinner. I just don't like to drink and eat. Either I'm going to eat or I'm going to drink. It's a belly full of rice is bad enough, but then I'm going to pour fizzy beer on top of it, and the rice starts to expand. I mean, my stomach felt like a giant rice cooker that's going to, you know, the top is going to blow off. All in all, I'm telling you, dinner for two, if you can call it two, was about $35. That's with drinks. I mean, I felt like taking a helicopter home. Hey, I think it's time for a beer break. Let's have some of this. It's hard to get an IPA just right, you know it? I mean, I read these stories of massive amounts of Chinook, Amarillo, Warrior hops, and you just dump them in there, and the next thing you know, you've got a beer that just tastes like battery acid. I mean, there's a true art to making an IPA that, you know, comes out this smooth. And we did that Dude Night IPA when we did the How to Brew with Dude Night video, and that came out really good. And I've made a couple IPAs that were just singing, and then the next time I make them, and they're tart. I'm trying to find that balance myself, and I've made good ones, I've made bad ones, but you know, to get it down to this to a professional level would just be awesome. You know, as I said earlier, I was going to pull audio from other podcasts to show how they celebrated their anniversaries, but I didn't want to embarrass myself in this pool of loneliness that I have here. It's a one-man show, but I'm going to play you one clip. I pulled it from Big Foamy Head. Big Foamy Head, they did 40 shows and drank 175 beers. Then they celebrated their first anniversary. Listen to this.
Welcome to show 41, the anniversary show, BigFoamyHead.com.
40 shows later, 175 beers. We've talked about on the show. We've drunk more, but
yeah. That's an amazing number, though. 175 beers.
Unique ones. And compiled the list, and we'll go ahead and put that out on the website for you guys.
Okay, great. Yeah, so it's good stuff.
Peruse it.
And, you know, we've talked about this. We mentioned it on some of the previous shows. And you know, a year in podcasting is apparently a long, long time since podcasting hasn't been around that much. And
people brought stuff. Mm-hmm. We had potato salad. And
had a big cake.
Coleslaw and a cake.
Yeah. And we also had a beer or two.
A couple.
And what did we have?
One case of Dogfish Head 90-minute IPA. Mm. A case of Dogfish Head 60-minute IPA.
Mm-hmm.
A case of Sam Adams Summer Brews. And a case of home brews.
That's right. Some of your home brews. The Amarillo Ales and the German Alts.
That's right.
So we had enough beer. And it was good. It was all iced down. We had coolers. We had the whole deal set up. Perfect weather. And
it was hot.
Yeah, it was hot out by the pool. And all these people, you know, swimming in there. And
you made a five-hour DVD mix of blues.
I did. I pulled pretty much all of the music that we had played over the course of the year and threw in some extra ones. Threw it all on a DVD, and we set up the stereo in the backyard.
It was fun listening to those. It was kind of like, you know, old friends,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, because you were saying, oh, yeah, I remember when we did that one. So it was a big time. Everybody was there, all of the folks that you've heard throughout the year. A couple of them didn't make it, but, you know, they'll be reappearing again.
I mean, come on. How am I supposed to compete with that? How is anybody going to compete with that? They have this huge-ass party, big cake, barbecue, and these guys can grill. Let me tell you, these guys, these are barbecue kings. And a bunch of people came over. They had beers, two cases of Dogfish Head, case of Sam Adams, a case of Homebrews 2. Jesus. Here's how I celebrated my one-year anniversary, okay? Thank you, everybody, for coming, for celebrating with me tonight. There's food and drinks over in the corner. Seriously, it was a hell of a good time. Have you ever thought that, you know, maybe you've seen everything? You know, you've seen everything. Then something comes up and you say, oh, damn. All right, now I've seen everything. Well, I do that a lot. Then something like this comes along. Gordon Ramsay's Hell's Kitchen video game. I haven't played it because I'm not all that into video games, really. I'm not much of a video game guy. I mean, I play it a little bit, but not too much. But from the review that I read, in this video game, you're put in charge of Hell's Kitchen restaurant. Takes you 5 weeks. You go from dishwasher to senior chef. You cook and you serve. So you work the back of the house and you work the front of the house. And as it progresses, the dishes get harder to make and then more people come into the restaurant. And of course, there's Ramsay yelling at you.
Right. Well, I'll get you more pumpkin. I'll ram it right up your fucking ass. Would you like it whole or diced?
It's $20, so it's not expensive. And I couldn't find a link anywhere to buy it. Not that I really looked that hard. Anyway, there it is. If you're watching that horrible show, and that's not enough for you, and you know you feel like taking some of that abuse home with you, here's your chance. Gordon Ramsay's Hell's Kitchen video game. I'd looked on Amazon. They're not selling it. I think that's pretty much where you would go to buy video games, right? I mean, where do you shop for those? Well, if any of you know me personally, you know that I love advertising. If it wasn't for advertising, I would not have a business. I wouldn't be making money. I really love advertising, especially food advertising. I have a great appreciation for really good food photography, especially when they include recipes and ideas for meals, stuff like that. Some of my favorite ads are those that are interactive, kind of like scratch and sniff ads. Somebody upped the ante just a little bit with this peel and taste advertising. They're little edible strips of film that now appear in ads for Welch's grape juice. You peel the film off and you put it in your mouth and you sample the flavor of the juice. Now, I think this is awesome because it opens up food advertising to a whole new level. The only problem I see is that, you know, it has to be chemically based in some way because there's no real way to emulate the flavor of something without using an artificial flavoring compound anyway. But it's catching on because other products are now on board with the idea. Sunny Delight is doing it, Campbell's Soup, Kellogg, and Sky Vodka. Now, that one caught my eye. Vodka? Really? I mean, how are they going to get around the idea of putting vodka in a magazine? Then I read it's non-alcoholic. Now, who in the hell is going to want to taste a non-alcoholic vodka? I mean, it's practically flavorless to begin with. So, of course, leave it to some companies to turn it in another direction. I read that a Florida anti-smoking campaign is creating a strip that tastes like the bottom of an ashtray. Yeah, thanks. I think this could be the future of shopping. I mean, for people who shop the inside aisles for stuff that, you know, is made of chemistry. You know, Pop-Tarts, the processed stuff. I mean, I wonder what this tastes like. You grab a strip, you have a sample, and if you like it, you buy it. It'll help sell products. I do know one thing. If I want to know what an apricot or an apple tastes like, that's pretty easy. And the person selling it to me at the farmer's market is going to cut off a chunk and hand it to me. It's as easy as that. I think they should, like, make frogwas strips. Or beef jerky strips. Oh, beer. They should figure out a way to get beer flavors on strips. Imagine that. If you'd save so much money when you experiment with new beers. I mean, some of the stuff that we drink, like, you know, this beer I bought, 22 ounce, $6.
That's not too expensive for a craft beer. But, you know, for some people, it could be expensive, and, you know, but I'm doing it because I really have an appreciation for it, and I want to support the breweries. But, yeah, if you're, like, on a budget, and you wanted to, you know, try some beers, and you wanted to taste them, could they possibly do that? I doubt it. You make flavor strips? Because it has to have chemicals in it, and this is a natural thing. And that's my point. Hey, CNN ran this story recently, and I wanted to share it with you because it's such a great piece. A farmer's market in Santa Barbara and a local Chinese restaurant are donating food to help the poor. Now, this is food that would otherwise be thrown away, and it goes to feed the homeless or people who are just low on money and would be in food lines. I mean, in the farmer's market, I mean, stuff that they don't sell, that gets soft or it's overly ripe, and they're going to toss it. And a lot of the stuff ends up just being in mulch. So what they do is they'll take it and they'll bring it to these people, and they'll give it to them, and then, of course, they'll eat it.
From the strawberry fields of Santa Maria, California, to a free farmer's market in Santa Barbara. From the excess of a Chinese lunch buffet,
gosh, is it good,
to the table of a homeless family. This is a story about a network of regular people you rarely hear about. People who have busy lives and jobs, but donate their time, their goods and services to help feed the poor.
I just don't think any food should be going to waste.
For Nancy Kapp, it started with a simple question when she and a friend went to lunch. What happens to all that food that isn't sold? They asked the owner, Mei Jung Lu, if they could have it.
She said, yes, you know, we do have leftover. And if she can come pick it up every afternoon after the buffet, then she's welcome to have it.
You toss the food, it's very bad. You know, it's still, I always thinking, still has a lot of people out here, doesn't have anything to eat.
Bins of fresh food that would end up in the trash.
Hello.
But for the last 2 months, Kapp, who is an outreach counselor for the homeless, picks up extra food from Madame Lou's restaurant and takes it to the homeless, like the Clements, who live in a parking lot.
It's great because we don't get to eat out. It helps for our food bill, or, you know, adds to that. Everybody just enjoys it.
On a much larger scale, California farmers are kicking in tons of produce that will end up at a free farmers market for the poor and elderly. Surplus produce that might be cosmetically imperfect that would normally be plowed under. George Adams of A&A Farming says he donates about 70,000 pounds of lettuce each year. Patrick Sheehy, who grows for Driscoll Farm, says they donate more than 1.5 million pounds of berries a year.
We've paid for the harvesting cost and the packaging cost, so there is a direct cost to me. But it's you know, it's better to put it on somebody's table than throw it in the dump.
It's not all about the bottom line all the time. It's, you know, it can come back in much greater ways.
For 78-year-old Joseph McNulty, the free produce means he doesn't have to make hard choices.
Could take that money and buy medicine.
A reason why so many businesses are committed.
Times are tough on everyone, including business people like yourself.
Oh, it is. Very, very tough time right now. Even my restaurant, they have about 20% drop to all the business. But still, you can do it. This is little things you can help.
Mei Jung and the others who've come up with this food solution say what they're doing isn't new, but it is critical as more Americans end up in food lines.
Thanks again to CNN for that piece. It's just so great to see people reaching out to help others, and it's such a great PR piece for American farmers in general. I mean, look at them doing their part to help Americans. Then look at what the foreign farmers are doing to you, giving us salmonella. I mean, American farmers help feed the poor. What do foreign farmers give you? Thank you. What are you going to stand behind? I'm just saying. Hey, you know what? We were talking about gaming earlier, this video games. You know about this gaming console? It's called the Wii. It's an interesting concept for a console because you have more interaction with the game. And they were talking about it recently on the confrontation board. Angry Barcode, she bought one, and her and Chud play it. And it's actually kind of cool. You actually swing and you push and you move. And you move the game along physically rather than just pushing buttons or joystick and sitting on your fat ass, you know? It's pretty cool. I mean, I played a lot at a friend's house. Golf, bowling, a lot of fun. Tennis. I love tennis. They unveiled this new game. It's called Major League Eating, the game. It's a competitive eating game where you apparently hold this special joystick. It looks like food. And you control your character eating against another competitive eater. Now, I don't know a whole lot about competitive eating because I think it's a real stupid idea. And it's typical of Americans flaunting their wealth and their opulence. But I guess you race the clock to see who can eat more of something inside of 1 minute or whatever. But I guess in this game, it works the same way, and you're disqualified if you eat too fast or too much and you throw up. Now, can you imagine that? It's not bad enough that you're overeating in a video game, but you can actually puke in the game too. I mean, what the hell is happening to this country? Or to humans in general? I mean, this is sick and twisted. I thought about it too. Because if there's anything we need more right now, given the fact that the world's faced with food shortages and global hunger crisis, it's a game where we can pretend to speed eat as much as we can until we eat too much and vomit. And the most ironic thing about this entire thing is the fact that we just released what they call Wii Fit, where you actually sit on this table, this tablet, and you do yoga, calisthenics, push-ups, stuff like that. You can actually work out with it. And then you can overeat afterward, I guess. Interesting article my wife handed me over the weekend from our local paper, Orange County Register. It was a big piece on kitchen gardens and how they've become more popular now. So food prices are going on the rise, of course, so the sales of fruit trees and seeds are on the rise as well. So people start planting their own gardens and they're growing their own food. Now, if there's any good to come out of all this, I think it's this. Because, you know, once you start growing your own stuff, and you start eating your own food, and your dinner table has food on it that you grew, and you taste how good it is, and you're actually involved with your food. I mean, getting really close to it, bringing it to life, everything changes. I mean, suddenly that two-week-old cucumber that you bought at the market isn't going to do it for you anymore. They did have a section in here, food worth growing. You know, all food is fun to grow if you just do it once, but if you're just starting out, you don't have limited space, and you want to get the most return on your initial seed and your, you know, water investment, there are some that work and some that don't. So the things that they say that are good to grow are perennial and annual herbs, beets, carrots, lettuce, greens, green beans, squash, cucumber, eggplant, tomato, garlic, peppers, potatoes, fruit trees, citrus, avocado, berry, and mini pumpkins. The things they say not to grow, because it's not worth your trouble, corn, well, we know about that. Onion, celery, endive, watermelon, cantaloupe, large pumpkin. I think it's a water thing. I mean, it takes a lot of water to grow a watermelon, obviously. I thought it was a great article to read, though. It's just sad that it had to come to this. But I'm really happy for it because people who have always thought of starting a garden will now do it. And maybe they'll continue once the food crisis ends, if it ever does. Of course, you know, they should know to grow some drought-tolerant stuff as well, especially if they live in climates like mine, they don't get a lot of rainfall. Hey, guess what? This show is over! That's it for My Life as a Foodie. Thanks to Okie Dokie for the great meal, to Port Brewing for the fantastic Hop 15 IPA, portbrewing.com. Thanks to CNN for the audio, to Afterlife for their song Shine On, and to you for tuning in yet again. I hope to bring another year to the table. We'll roll with the changes, see where it takes us. Cheers to our anniversary. I have something Japanese in store next time, but it's not what you think, so be prepared for that. After that, we're going to go Mexican. Because too much of a good thing is a very good thing. My name is Phil. This is My Life as a Foodie. And I will see you next time. Shine on, everybody.